Many people already know that there's something not quite right about the current climate change fear-mongering going on in our world. But few have really fingered exactly where this fear-mongering and this agenda is coming from. In this film series, we will attempt to pull the curtain off the puppet masters, whose goal is depopulation and the cementing of socialist and communist ideologies throughout the world.
It's not some science fantasy effect from 2001. This electronic display emanating from Australia's largest computer is a picture of the condition, past, present and future of planet Earth. The program was originally devised by a scientist working from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Jay Forrester. It was developed under the auspices of the Club of Rome by an MIT research team to present a complex model of the world and what we humans are doing to it. The program, called World One, doesn't pretend to be a precise forecast. What it does for the first time in man's history on the planet is to look at the world as one system. It shows that Earth cannot sustain present population and industrial growth for much more than a few decades. It shows that simply cleaning up our car exhausts and making some small effort to limit our families simply isn't enough. It's like an electronic guided tour of our global behavior since 1900 and where that behavior will lead us. Well, this is the printed version of what we've just seen on the television screen. What looks at first to be just a maze of computer characteristics is really a system of very simple graphs which project what's going to happen to the planet over the next 150 years if we don't do something drastic to stop it. Down the left-hand side of the graph is the date, 1900, 1940, 1980, 2020, right down to 2060. Now, each of these lines of letters represents a curve showing some aspect of the condition of the planet. The further out this way they go, the greater that figure is. The further this way, the less. For example, P represents population. So here it is at 1900. And then it comes up to 1940, it starts to take off. Here we are at 1980, up to the turn of the century, and then it starts to peter off. Let's now have a look at this next curve, the Q curve, which is the quality of life. And this is represented by, for example, the amount of space people have, the amount of money they have to spend, the amount of food they have to eat. Now, it increases rapidly up to 1940, but from 1940 on, the quality of life diminishes. And here we are about the turn of the century and we come up to the year 2020 and it's really come right back. More people, of course, means that you start to chew up your supply of natural resources. And this is this curve here, the N curve. And it shows that slowly but steadily the pool of natural wealth in the world, natural resources, minerals, oil and so on, is slowly but steadily diminishing. So this is the situation. As population increases, the quality of life decreases and the supply of natural resources decreases. But have a look at this curve here. This is called the Z curve and it represents pollution. Now, predictably enough, as the population increases up to 1980, pollution increases. There's more rubbish. But from 1980 to the year 2020, pollution really takes off. This is assuming, of course, that we don't do anything about it. So the year 2020, the condition of the planet starts to become highly critical. And if we don't do anything about it, this is what's going to happen. The quality of life is going to go right back to practically zero. Pollution is going to become so serious, right out here, that it will start to kill people. So the population will diminish. Right back here, less than it was in the year 1900. And at this stage, round about the year 2040, 2050, civilized life as we know it on this planet will cease to exist. Well, hopefully, of course, it won't be allowed to happen. But it's taken this kind of shock treatment to nudge governments into doing something, and slowly we are. We're starting to clean up our atmosphere. We're starting to recycle our rubbish. We're doing something positive about population control. But so far, our efforts have really been just a drop in the ocean. The Club of Rome comprises some 70 men of widely varying backgrounds. But their common concern is that the world problems cannot be solved by individual nations. I spoke with Professor Hugo Thiemann, director of the Battelle Institute, Geneva, Dr. Aurelio Pache, founder of the club, and Dr. Alexander King, director of the World Bank and the United Nations OECD. Dr. King, now you're describing the world as a closed system where all these things are interrelated, and yet the government, the control of the system is by individual nation states. Now, how do you convince them to cooperate?
The sovereignty of these nations is no longer as absolute as it was. There's a gradual diminishing, whittling away of sovereignty, little bit by little bit. Especially, of course, in the smaller countries, where it's more obvious. But the bigger countries have to do a good deal of this by agreeing to international arrangements for the law of the seas, or for the limits of fishing, or for control of the wavelengths in radio, and 101 other things. But especially in the technological field, I think this is going to be increasingly so because of developments next year. I was at an important meeting in Washington a couple of weeks ago, and Peterson, the former Secretary of Commerce, was saying the same thing from an economic point of view, that the general world economic situation, the interdependence of countries on their food and fuels and so on, is leading to an interdependence which has seeds of draining away of sovereignty within it. So I don't think one can envisage an idealistic of jumping to a world federalism or anything of that sort. But the building up probably in the next decade in a number of particularly sensitive fields like energy, raw materials, the use of the oceans, space and so on, of a number of what people are tending to call regimes, which will not be ordinary United Nations type of organizations, but semi-management organizations. There'll be a great deal of consent in them.
Dr. Bache views the European Common Market as an elementary example of the kind of regional cooperative which is going to be necessary. What responsibilities does he see for Australia?
Australia, you are in a splendid position.
What should we do?
You have food, energy, space. You are distant from other centers, so you can, for a longer time, feel rather more independent than interdependent. But things of the world are going so fast that I think that an enlightened leadership in Australia should see down the road that Australia will have to lose some of its own self-decisions in order to acquire something else which may be purely political in very wide sense, or maybe also security.
The Club of Rome is reluctant to point the finger at any one nation. Yet clearly, nations like the United States, which consumes approximately 60% of the world's resources, will, in the club's view, have to accept a severe cutback in its voracious appetite. But the club's utterances are cloaked in a velvet democracy, in the hope that their facts will gently persuade.
We will ask who is making the decision, and whether the decision makers of today, whether they perceive the problems, what kind of problems, and the interactions of the problems. That's a very pragmatic approach.
Has the time come, Dr. King, when we're going to have to say we can no longer entrust our resources and the exploitation of those resources to private enterprise? Has the time come when governments will simply have to take more control?
Simple nationalization and things like that wouldn't help at all, because we've got to keep an incentive approach. And many of the good aspects of private enterprise are very necessary here. but not in the old exploitative way where the market forces dominated the whole situation.
Dr. Pichai, can you tell me what my lifestyle will be in 100 years' time? What sort of car I'll drive, what sort of house I'll live in, what sort of food I'll be eating?
Probably you will have a smaller car. You will use more common transport means. You will work far less hours. You will have a wider culture. Cultural possibilities that today you will not be so much pressed by immediate needs, because through technology, organization of the markets, the basic needs will be taken care of. And I think that you will love nature and continue then what I think you are doing now, to protect our environment, to avoid this man-made world where the creatures of nature, the animals, the plants, the green spaces, the wildernesses are bound to disappear.
To the Club of Rome, the status symbols of the year 2000 will be the inverse of today's. Prestige will stem from low consumption. That personal consumption will have to be less is plain enough. But for that privation to be seen as prestigious would seem to indicate some radical rethinking, at least for the fat cats of the planet.
The Club of Rome is a global think tank that was founded in April 1968 by a group of scientists, economists, business leaders, and other influential individuals from around the world. The organization was established with the aim of addressing the growing challenges and complexities of global issues, particularly in relation to sustainability, resource management, and the future of humanity. In 1965, Aurelio Puccei, an Italian industrialist, made a speech that proved inspirational to Alexander King, the Scottish head of science at the OECD. The two found that they shared a profound concern for the long-term future of humanity and the planet, in what they termed the modern predicament of mankind. 3 years later, King and Puccei convened a meeting of European scientists in Rome. Although this first attempt failed to achieve unity, a core group of like-minded thinkers emerged. Their goal, to advance three core ideas that still define the Club of Rome today: a global and long-term perspective, and the concept of the problematique, a cluster of intertwined global problems, be they economic, environmental, political, or social.
What was the real message of limits to growth? The human ecological footprint cannot continue to grow at the rate seen from 1900 to 1972, for more than 100 years from 1972. It is possible, and even likely, that the human ecological footprint will overshoot the sustainable limits, equals the carrying capacity, of planet Earth. Once sustainable limits have been overshot, contraction is unavoidable. Overshoot can be avoided through forward-looking global policy. It is important to act as soon as possible. In 1972, that was by 1975. Summing up, the fundamental message of limits to growth: global society is likely to overshoot and then be forced to decline or collapse because of significant reaction delays in the global economy, caused by the time society needs to identify and accept global limits, by the institutional delays involved in decision-making, and by the time it needs to show results once action has been taken.
In this year's annual letter, Melinda and I take the toughest questions we get asked and give our answers. One that's come up for a long time is, as we make the world healthier, is the population going to get so big that feeding everybody and maintaining the environment is going to be impossible? Here we can see a chart that looks at the total world population over the last several hundred years. And at first glance, this is a bit scary. We go from less than a billion in 1800, and then 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7.4 billion where we are today is happening even faster. So Melinda and I wondered whether providing new medicines and keeping children alive, would that create more of a population problem? What we found out is that as health improves, families choose to have less children. And this effect is very, very dramatic. We find that in every country of the world, this is repeated. The population growth goes down as we improve health. So we've taken that chart that shows the global population growth, and we've actually extended it out all the way to 2100. And we can see that instead of continuing, it actually flattens out. Another way to see that is through this rate of population growth. And you can see that in the 60s, that reached a pretty high number, over 2% per year. And it's now come way, way down. Now, 11 billion people, still a lot. But the good news is that the faster we improve health, the faster family size goes down. And so we can feel great about saving those lives.
At the group's first major gathering in 1970, Jay Forrester, a systems professor at MIT, offered to use computer models he had developed to study the complex problems which concerned the group more rigorously. An international team of researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology began a study of the implications of unbridled exponential growth. They examined the five basic factors that determine and in their interactions ultimately limit growth on this planet: population, agriculture, non-renewable resource depletion, industrial output, and pollution. The media drumbeat for the Green New Deal agenda and the many cries for government to reduce the carbon footprint to save the planet make you wonder where all this is coming from and why. Many people fear that this is less a grassroots initiative and more a power elite agenda for reducing and eventually eliminating national sovereignty and creating their long-stated goal of a collectivist, one-world government.
Well, the first thing about the compass is that we understand that CO2 is not everything. The root cause of the big questions we have on the transition is first the resources, the use of resources, the materials efficiency, because, you know, it's the origin of 50% of the emissions, of 90% of biodiversity, and it's very important that we work on our overconsumption. So this is a very important matter. The other important matter that I take away from this morning, it's about the Green Deal. First, that Green Deal, is such that as we are going to import 70% of our needs for critical raw materials, for instance, in the next 10 years, it's very important that the Green Deal is open to the planet and especially to Global South as well, so that, as we have said this morning, EU is not a green island in a world which would be full of carbon.
Ecological disasters, climate change, hunger, overpopulation, shortage of resources. Can planet Earth still be saved, or is it too late? Scientist Dennis L. Meadows already asked this question 40 years ago.
I came back to MIT, walked into the office on Monday, and it was announced that a group I never heard about before, the Club of Rome, would be coming to MIT to learn about our computer modeling methods because they were interested in doing some kind of global study.
What is the Club of Rome? The Club of Rome members are politicians, scientists, economists, financial experts, and writers from around the world. Their common aim? Concern and responsibility for humanity's future. The Club of Rome is trying to find out how our life on Earth will develop and how to ensure a future worth living in. In 1972, Dennis Meadows was the first to be assigned with such future studies, financed by Volkswagen Foundation.
Then I put together a team of 16 people, and we worked for almost 2 years and produced the work. Limits to Growth was not the goal of the project. The goal was a very big scientific report, and Limits was written as a afterthought.
What is Limits to Growth? Limits to Growth is the summary of a complex study on the key question, what will our future look like if the world population keeps growing? And industrialization, pollution, food production and exploitation of natural resources continue unabated. A completely novel question in 1972. Following economic growth and increasing prosperity in the 50s and 60s, the upward trend seemed unlimited. Meadows' team simulated the seemingly limitless growth in a complicated computer model, with revolutionary results.
What we said is that exponential growth will take us to the limits very soon. Actually, if you look at our book, our 1972 book, although we showed many different scenarios, all of them show that growth stops sometime in the period of 2020 to, let's say, 2060. So, soon.
Where does growth reach its limit? Suddenly, it was obvious. The planet's wealth is limited. The unabated use of oil and natural resources, clearing of forests and overfishing will result in the extinction of species and the disappearance of landscapes. Our planet can only take so much harmful emissions like CO2 without any long-term damage. So there are limits to what our planet can endure without grave consequences. All ecological movements founded in the 70s used limits to growth as the basis of their reasoning. At that time, Meadows felt the limit hadn't yet been reached, but we have long since exceeded it, as global warming and rising sea levels show. So now what?
Will the current ideas about green industry and qualitative growth avoid collapse? No possibility. Absolutely no possibility of that.
Why not?
Why won't we avoid collapse? Well, many reasons, but one of them is that globally we are something like 60 or 70% above sustainable levels. Even making very optimistic calculations about what is sustainable.
Have we learned nothing since the 70s? We have. People's awareness has changed. Sustainability is the slogan of modern development and environmental policies. The Western industrial nation's promotion of environment-friendly production is a step in the right direction, but according to Meadows, it won't suffice to prevent the collapse. So, what else can we do, Mr. Meadows?
Will it be possible here in Germany to continue this level of energy consumption and this degree of material welfare? Absolutely not. Not in the United States, not in other countries either. Could you change your cultural and your social norms in a way that gave a attractive future? Yes, you could. It will be in a future which much lower energy and material use, but of course, most of the important things in life don't require energy and material. They're knowledge, learning, music. These are things which can be done with much lower levels of energy and material flow. Will you choose to do that? I don't see any reason to think that you will. It seems to me the leaders of the West, of the industrialized West, are desperately trying to do everything they can to maintain the current situation. So that means there, you won't avoid the collapse.
The Club of Rome was founded during a meeting at David Rockefeller's private estate in Bellagio, Italy. Club members include Henry Kissinger, Zbigniew Brzezinski, George Soros, Bill Gates, Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands, and Mikhail Gorbachev. They believe humanity requires a common motivation, namely a common adversary, in order to realize their goal of world government. Aside from full members, there are associate members who participate in research and projects but have no vote in the General Assembly. The club also has honorary members. Notable honorary members include Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands, Orio Giorini, Fernando Cardoso, Mikhail Gorbachev, King Juan Carlos of Spain, Horst Kohler, and many more. The annual General Assembly took place in Berlin on November 10th and 11th, 2016. Among the guest speakers were former German President Christian Wolf, German Minister for Economic Cooperation and Development Gerd Müller, as well as Nobel laureate Muhammad Yunus. Other associate members include Bono and Bob Geldof, who we already know is up to no good, as we discussed in my film The Spellcasters Volume 4. Even climate activist Greta Thunberg has the backing and support of the Club of Rome.
In 1977, the worst winter in a century struck the United States. Arctic cold gripped the Midwest for weeks on end. Great blizzards paralyzed cities of the Northeast. One desperate night in Buffalo, eight people froze to death in marooned cars. Pat Bushnell was on the road that night.
Traffic just absolutely stopped. I was afraid of being stuck in the car all night long with the cold and the wind, running out of gas. And then what? I think that if we had to go through a real bad winter, just like we just went through, I think we'd have to think about moving someplace else.
Move where? The brutal Buffalo winter might become common all over the United States. Climate experts believe the next ice age is on its way. According to recent evidence, it could come sooner than anyone had expected. At weather stations in the far north, temperatures have been dropping for 30 years. Seacoasts, long free of summer ice, are now blocked year-round. According to some climatologists, within a lifetime, we might be living in the next ice age.
Concern about air quality usually centers on pollution, as in the ironic observation, if you can't see it, don't breathe it. Increased reliance on coal is a crucial part of the Carter administration energy program. But the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee heard warnings today that a coal-burning society may be making things hot for itself. Nelson Benton reports.
The so-called greenhouse effect is created by carbon dioxide, a colorless, odorless gas. In small concentrations, it helps to sustain almost all life on Earth. The relatively small amounts of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere filter the warming rays of the sun to the Earth's surface. But like a greenhouse, carbon dioxide also prevents heat given off by the Earth from escaping into space. Researchers say increasingly large amounts of CO2 are accumulating in the atmosphere. They fear the Earth will gradually become warmer, causing as yet uncertain but possibly disruptive changes in the Earth's climate 50 to 70 years from now. Fossil fuels, when burned, release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Coal, the worst culprit, oil and natural gas to lesser degrees. Scientists and a few politicians are beginning to worry that global energy planning does not take the greenhouse effect seriously enough. If the Earth gets too warm, for example, ice caps could melt, raising the level of the seas.
Possible, probable, we really don't know. But if it happens, it means goodbye Miami, goodbye Corpus Christi, goodbye Sacramento, goodbye Boston, which obviously is much more of a concern. Goodbye New Orleans. Goodbye Charleston, Savannah, and Norfolk. On the positive side, it means that we could enjoy boating at the foot of the Capitol and fishing on the South Lawn.
One model of climate, the Jason climate model, predicts that doubling carbon dioxide will result in August in Washington, D.C., that are 9 degrees centigrade warmer, or 16 degrees Fahrenheit, than current summers, but that the winters will only be 2 degrees centigrade warmer. Changes of this magnitude are very probably going to have a profound effect on agriculture, on all aspects of energy use and generation, and on water and land use.
One scientist put the urgency of the greenhouse potential in biblical terms, citing the warning given to Noah in the Old Testament. Noah knew trouble was coming, he said, and he prepared for it. Nelson Benton, CBS News, Capitol Hill.
The Club has national associations in 35 countries and territories. The mission of the national associations is to spread the ideas and vision in their respective countries, to offer solutions and to lobby for a more sustainable and just economy in their nations, and support the International Secretariat with the organization of events such as the Annual General Assembly. Ever since its founding, the Club of Rome has been establishing a network of 35 national associations, and their many tentacles have influenced and have been systematically propagating their catastrophic future vision into the mainstream of global public opinion. They've been doing this through their controlled mass media cartel, as well as the philanthropic foundations and corporations, to fund research grants by approved scientists to advance their hypothesis, including man-made global warming and the dying off of the polar bears, and treating those issues as being settled science. Today, their theories and proposed action plans have entered the educational establishment. Think tanks and activist organizations, the mass media, political action committees, and Capitol Hill.
The Club of Rome is a global network of independent and renowned thinkers. The Club of Rome analyzes today's challenges facing the world, their root causes, and the possible futures in a systematic and holistic manner. The Club of Rome encourages global debate in order to set in motion actions that by the middle of the century will ensure a more secure, equitable, and prosperous world.
Australians coping with worsening traffic and suburban sprawl, the projection that Australia's population would nearly double by the middle of the century was not what they wanted to hear.
I actually believe in a big Australia.
But then came a new Prime Minister and an election campaign fought on the urban fringes of the big capital cities, where squeezing in more people was not a popular option.
Let's take a breath and get it right. Let's not make as our national goal the goal of a big Australia. Let's make our national goal a sustainable Australia.
What that sustainable Australia would be was left to a new minister and a new national population strategy. Today, Tony Burke headed to the epicentre of Australia's urban growth, Queensland's Gold Coast, to outline what that strategy would be.
Once we get to the core of the economic drivers and making sure that we've got issues of infrastructure being able to be taken into account, and acknowledging that so much of the environmental footprint isn't about our total number, but it's about where we live and how we live.
The Minister is determined to avoid any population target or cap.
Sustainable Australia, sustainable communities. The right way to deal with population policy is not through an arbitrary and ultimately senseless debate about total numbers.
A cynical exercise in cutting and pasting previous government announcements and putting them in a glossy document does not amount to a sustainable population strategy. I mean, seriously, the Women's Weekly's royal wedding coverage, I think, only exceeds this document in terms of its commitment to glossy photos. 10% of the document is literally glossy full-page photos.
While the shadow immigration minister accuses the government of being light on detail, he doesn't want to commit to a population target either.
Coalition's very prepared to support policies that ensures a greater spread of the population and supports regional areas. But we shouldn't kid ourselves that that happens overnight, and we shouldn't kid ourselves that that absolves a government from the responsibility of seeking to manage things that were within its control, which is obviously the migration program.
The typical Australian are going to have less because there's the same size cake with more people sharing it, everyone gets less.
The philanthropist and entrepreneur Dick Smith made his first fortune selling consumer electronics. He rode waves of economic growth. Now he wants to get off.
I've benefited from the growth economy without any doubt more than most people, but I've come to realise that it's going to destroy Australia and the world for our children and grandchildren.
Dick Smith does have a population target in mind, and he says where Australia is headed is unsustainable.
It's been claimed that we're going to go to 36 million or so. Wayne Goss says it's inevitable. Well, over my dead body, because I can tell you the quality of life for people then will be an absolute disaster. It's nothing but a downside now to go to more and more people in Australia, indeed to go to more and more people in the world.
The demographer Peter McDonald from the Australian National University says the government's decision to avoid long-term targets is sound, but he says it could have tried to look a few years ahead.
I think it might have focused on population growth in the next decade at least, to be more specific about that, because I think in the next decade it's pretty clear that migration is going to remain relatively high. If we're going to have 250,000 new jobs in Australia each year, and the domestic labour supply will at best produce about 100,000 of those.
Professor McDonald says the real driver of population growth is not government policy, but the state of the economy.
Throughout Australian history, migration has been driven by labour demand in Australia. And there are periods in Australia, and sometimes long periods in Australia, where migration was close to zero because there was very little labour demand in Australia, say in the 1930s, but also in mid-1970s, early 1990s. But we're now in a period of very strong labour demand, and we can expect lots of migration as a result of that.
The Minister says even short-term predictions are difficult to make.
If you were to set targets 5 years ago, it would have been done without knowing anything that we're about to have a global financial crisis, nor understanding the implications of mining boom Mark II, where the dollar would end up, where our terms of trade would go.
Or whether the Australia of the future will need to be that big.
Brendan Chembath report.
But in one way or another, we are so far, globally, we are so far above the population and the consumption levels which can be supported by this planet that I know in one way or another it's going to come back down. So I don't hope to avoid that. I hope that it can occur in a civil way. I mean civil in a special way. Peaceful. Peace doesn't mean that everybody's happy, but it means that conflict isn't solved through violence, through force, but rather in other ways. And so that's what I hope for. That we can, I mean, the planet can support something like a billion people, maybe 2 billion, depending on how much liberty and how much material consumption you want to have. If you want more liberty and more consumption, you have to have fewer people. And conversely, you can have more people. I mean, we could even have 8 or 9 billion, probably, if we have a very strong dictatorship, which is smart. Unfortunately, you never have smart dictatorships. They're always stupid. So, but if you had a smart dictatorship and a low standard of living, you can have it. But we want to have freedom and we want to have a high sentence. So we're going to have 1 billion people. And we're now at 7. So we have to get back down. I hope that this can be slow, relatively slow, and that it can be done in a way which is relatively equal, so that people share the experience and you don't have a few rich, trying to force everybody else to deal with it. So those are my hopes. I mean, these are pretty pessimistic hopes, but I mean, that's what lies ahead.
The Club of Rome gained significant attention with the publication of its report titled The Limits to Growth in 1972. This report, commissioned by the club, was prepared by a team of researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, led by Dennis Meadows. It presented a computer model that simulated the interactions between various factors such as population growth, industrialization, pollution, food production, and resource depletion. The Limits to Growth report warned that if the world continued on its current trajectory of exponential population growth and resource consumption, it would eventually face ecological and economic collapse. The model projected that if global trends continued, the Earth's finite resources would be depleted within a few decades, leading to a decline in living standards and a potential societal collapse. The report sparked intense debate and controversy. Critics argued that the model was overly pessimistic and failed to account for technological advancements and human ingenuity that could potentially address the challenges outlined in this report. However, supporters of the report argued that it served as a wake-up call, highlighting the need for long-term planning and sustainable development. One of the main tenets of the Club of Rome is the idea that national GDPs need to fall along with populations for there to be an environmentally sustainable future. Here are the main issues that are most concerning about the Club of Rome. The common conspiracy theory is that the Club of Rome seeks to control and reduce the world's population using forced sterilization, mass abortions, and have even engineered pandemics to achieve this goal. When you look at just what the group itself has said in its own words, and how global temperatures decline during the pandemic lockdowns, it's pretty obvious that the Club of Rome may very well have been behind it. Some conspiracy theorists believe that the Club of Rome is part of a global elite working towards a new world order, where a small group of individuals would have complete control over society and world affairs. They allege that the Club of Rome is involved in planning and orchestrating this agenda. When one examines the stated goals of the Club of Rome, this belief becomes very hard to ignore. Another belief about the Club of Rome is that they deliberately fabricated environmental crises and climate change to manipulate public opinion and gain power. Critics claim they exaggerate the severity of these issues to advance their own agendas. This is hard to argue, since the main driver of climate change on Earth, the sun, is never mentioned once, even as a contributing factor to climate change, when in fact, it is the main driver of it. Other conspiracy theorists believe the Club of Rome intends to establish a world government or a supranational authority that would supersede national sovereignty. This theory often connects the Club of Rome to other organizations such as the United Nations and the Bilderberg Group in a grand scheme for global control. And again, when one examines the evidence, these accusations by conspiracy theorists become very hard to ignore. Some theorists argue that the Club of Rome influences global economics and global financial systems for their own benefit. They claim the organization manipulates markets, currency, and resources to consolidate power and wealth. When you consider the group's association with the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, yet again, we have another fact and connection that is completely hard to ignore. If any group fits the bill to be most likely behind chemtrails, it's the Club of Rome. The fact that chemtrails, an aerosol spraying, can be used to both cool and heat the planet, combined with the fact that many of these spray planes have NATO markings, makes the Club of Rome the likely culprit behind the ongoing geoengineering campaigns to further the club's climate agendas.
The record number of fires burning across Brazil's Amazon rainforest has prompted renewed global outcry over climate change and big spending. $5 million from Leonardo DiCaprio, £10 million from the UK. Meanwhile, Bill Gates is backing the first high-altitude experiment of one radical climate change solution, creating a massive chemical cloud that could cool the Earth. It's called solar geoengineering, and it's highly controversial.
How long will it be that countries keep experiencing these climate impacts before someone gets desperate and says, hey, we need to cool the planet with solar geoengineering?
It would look something like this. Thousands of planes would fly very high and use nozzles to inject millions of tons of light-reflecting particles into the stratosphere. It would create a thin chemical cloud of those particles around the whole planet, blocking some sunlight from reaching the surface. It would mimic a giant volcanic eruption, which we know cools the Earth. Back in 1991, Mount Pinatubo erupted in the Philippines, It was the largest eruption to affect a densely populated area, creating avalanches and giant mud flows that left more than 700 dead and 30,000 homeless. It also spewed a cloud of 20 million tons of sulfur dioxide particles into the stratosphere. That chemical cloud was hundreds of miles across and reflected about 2% of sunlight back to space. And in 1992, the Earth was cooler than in 1991.
That is part of the mechanism, but you do this in a controlled way.
Modeling studies have found that it could reduce the intensity of heat waves, for instance. Apparently it could reduce the rate of sea level rise. It could reduce the intensity of tropical storms.
But it also comes with significant risks and uncertainties.
Things like mass famine, mass flooding, drought, of kinds that will affect very large populations.
It could weaken monsoons in India, China, and Africa enough to affect crops. It could eradicate blue sky.
You start increasing the amount of diffuse light and you have less direct light, which is the same thing as saying it looks hazy and white.
And if the global community decides it should stop?
So you stop injecting it, and after a year, the cloud is gone, and you get this rapid warming at a rate much faster than you would get if we had done nothing. If you've taken out the greenhouse gases that are adding to the warming, then the temperature won't go up, it'll stay what it is. So if we don't stop emitting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, we don't try as hard as we can to do that, then there's no point in doing solar geoengineering.
A 2016 opinion poll conducted by the Harvard group doing solar geoengineering research found that 67% of subjects support its use. One reason this technology is appealing, it's cheap. One study estimates it would cost an average of $2.25 billion globally every year for the first 15 years of deployment. Compare that to the $500 billion the U.S. government estimates it will cost just the U.S. by 2100 if no action is taken against climate change. Or the $1.6 to $3.8 trillion projected global spending by 2050 on low-carbon energy production. You can also compare it to direct air carbon capturing, another climate change solution backed by Bill Gates and by Big Oil. It involves sucking billions of tons of carbon out of the air. And at $100 to $200 a ton, it could be big business. Solar geoengineering, on the other hand, is so cheap that nobody currently stands to make money from the process.
But just because a solution is cheap doesn't make it a good one. It's cheap and dangerous.
It doesn't require a lot of materials. It doesn't require a big innovation. It basically affects the whole planet with one project. So that is not necessarily a situation that has a lot of profit opportunity, right? Because there's not going to be a lot of different people that can do it and compete in a marketplace.
Bill Gates is among a dozen individual donors and 14 foundations backing the first stratospheric solar geoengineering experiment out of Harvard. It's called Stratospheric Controlled Perturbation Experiment, or SCOPEX. A high-altitude balloon will lift instruments about 20 kilometers into the stratosphere, where it will release less than 2 kilograms of different naturally occurring chemicals, like calcium carbonate and sulfates, and then measure the change in atmospheric chemistry and light scattering. The Harvard group that runs SCOPEX and other experiments has raised more than $16 million, more than double any other solar geoengineering effort. And annual global funding has gone up from $1 million in 2008 to $8 million in 2018, with the majority of that funding coming from the U.S. The first phase of SCOPEX will cost around $3 million, with much more needed for wider research on solar geoengineering. To this point, stratosphere injections have only been tested with climate modeling. In the UK, a government-funded solar radiation management test called SPICE was cancelled in 2012 because of issues with patents.
We're not trying to develop any technology that is patented or where we want to make money with this later on.
A study last year found that no existing aircraft can inject the stratosphere at a high enough altitude, but developing a new high-altitude tanker would not be technologically difficult or prohibitively expensive. Nozzles still need to be designed that can continuously blast out trillions of particles, and scientists still need to decide what chemicals those particles should be made of. But unlike cloud brightening, which is another solar reflection technique, the tech needed for stratospheric injections is not far off.
The technology is not the main thing that's holding this back. The main thing that's holding it back is the uncertainty about what the exact effects would be and the positives and negatives of its effects, and the governance and decision-making process for implementing it.
Other radical attempts to control climate change have been tested in the past, like when one California businessman dumped 100 tons of iron dust in the Pacific to spawn the growth of carbon-absorbing plankton. But unlike small, sometimes rogue experiments, planet-wide solar geoengineering will require buy-in from the international community.
You know, in our simulations, we found China got warmer and drier relative to the past when you stabilized global temperature, and India was now cooler and wetter. So you can see there how, you know, international relations around using this technology could become complicated.
I mean, we can't even decide on what to do about emissions of greenhouse gases. And so how are we going to decide on setting the planetary thermostat?
There's this the real concern that we won't be able to reach agreement, we being the entire planet. And so there's the prospect that countries just go ahead and do solar geoengineering, and that causes disagreement, conflict, tension, even possibly war.
3 years ago, the international community did come together when almost 200 countries signed the Paris Agreement on Climate Change, agreeing to limit global temperature rise to less than 2 degrees Celsius. Since then, President Trump has stated his intent to withdraw from the agreement.
The Paris Climate Accord is simply the latest example of Washington entering into an agreement that disadvantages the United States.
And global emissions are not being reduced fast enough to reach these goals.
We know what we should be doing. What we should be doing is reducing carbon emissions. So we're creating a moral hazard. We are providing it out for you where you can say, well, I'm going to fix this technologically instead of doing the ethically right thing to do.
It's way too early to give up on much more ethical approaches to climate change. Right. The future generations were literally in the room to question us on our dubious arguments. We wouldn't get far with some of the kinds of arguments we're trying to offer for neglecting conventional climate policy and going down this path.
For now, the failure to rapidly reduce emissions has prompted more exploration of alternative solutions like carbon dioxide removal and solar geoengineering. But scientists warn we will still need to reduce emissions too.
If we're not cutting CO2 emissions at the same time, from my perspective, there's little point in doing this because you would have to start using ever-increasing amounts.
No responsible scientist says that it's a silver bullet. All the responsible scientists say this is something that we deploy if we had to, alongside all the other stuff that we already have to do.
The U.S. Academies of Sciences is holding a series of meetings to study solar geoengineering, including one at Stanford this month. The committee will issue a report next year with recommendations for how, or if, solar geoengineering research should continue. Some scientists say the research is necessary in order to arm future generations with the ability to enact this backup plan, even though it seems nearly impossible now.
We ought to start working on this solar climate engineering problem right now with as much urgency as we can, so that if we want to deploy it in a decade or so, we understand what we have to do.
This is a real moral horror, especially in a situation where we're not doing all the things that we could be doing to minimize the risks of climate catastrophe now.
But experts do agree that more public awareness is needed around solar geoengineering. Because within a couple decades, for better or worse, it could be part of the solution, helping return the planet to pre-industrial temperatures.
Without question, the Club of Rome is the most powerful group in the world, and their influence on the current state of our world is undeniable, as is their socialist beliefs. It's my belief this group is responsible for the COVID pandemic, as it fits right into their depopulation agenda laid out in their Limits to Growth report in 1972. It's time that the people of the world unite to shed light and eventually shut down this evil world superpower.